Scott Kalalusky versus BNSF Railway Company.
Mr. Hanson, when you're ready to proceed, please do so.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sam Hanson. With me at counsel table is Tara Dushinsky. We represent BNSF Railway in these three appeals that are consolidated for argument. They arise out of an FELA claim based upon a claim that the plaintiff was exposed to toxic odors while working in the North Town Yard of the railroad. My opponent has suggested that I use hyperbole in describing the orders of the district court. That's rarely suggested about a Norwegian. But there is no exaggeration to say in my 50 years of practice, I've never seen findings on highly contested facts made without an evidentiary hearing, based not on evidence but on the arguments of counsel, which arguments stitch together disconnected facts to raise conspiracy theories that are clearly refuted, even if enough to go to a jury are clearly refuted, ignoring all evidence to the contrary and resulting in a judgment of $20 million for a condition that medical experts say could not possibly be caused by the exposure incident. And I'd like to start with that causation issue because I think that's the most extreme error of the district court. Because we have said, and our medical experts have said, even if we were to assume all the facts about the exposure that the plaintiffs claim, assume that the 11 cars on the other track had hydrocarbons and even wellhead casing oil. We think we can prove they didn't, but assume that. Assume that they were coupled at an excessive speed. We think we can prove they were not, but assume that. Assume that that led to some release of the safety release valve, pressure valve, on the cars that emitted a gas that got over to Mr. Kalalusky. Assuming all that, we think we can disprove each of those. The medical testimony is that that type of transient exposure in an open environment cannot possibly cause, is not capable of causing the condition that the plaintiff claims, whether you call it Parkinson's, Parkinsonism, or any other permanent neurological injury.
Mr. Hanson, you're arguing the gist of what your defense would have been, but before we get there, we have Judge Dawson trying to manage extremely complex litigation. She issues numerous orders in which your client appears to be doing everything it can to thwart the progress of that hearing. She has to do something to take over control of the case. What did you feel that she should have done? I mean, first of all, let's start with the discovery. The discovery issues were represented as being able to produce I believe it was the 11 cars. Judge Dawson said in her order that it was a misrepresentation to the court that these cars were going to be produced.
There was a misunderstanding, I think, by Judge Dawson on the order to compel because BNSF's counsel said, we will try. We don't own them. We don't have control of them, but we will try to get the owners to agree to let us bring them.
Counsel, I'm going to interrupt you there because I'm looking at the transcript, and I think what your counsel said was they have to request them. The owner has to submit and agree to that. In general, they do because they're business customers.
Right.
That would lead a district court to think they're coming.
Certainly. Certainly, she could think from that they are coming. The question, though, comes then when the motion for sanction is brought because they were not produced.
It's not just that one factor for sanctions. We have the failure to preserve the evidence of the videotape as far as the scene. As I understand the record, a video that was submitted didn't even show the location where this incident occurred.
Well, there may have been some collateral video, but there are 121 hours of video, and it does show both the incident and the initial inspection of the incident.
Well, we could several hours equivocate all morning about what appellant did or didn't do or failed to do. we have from Judge Dawson some explicit findings of fact in terms of misconduct and what she perceived of in handling her trial court calendar, efforts to forego process of this case. What is it that she did that you find to be so out of her discretion when she's fashioning appropriate relief?
Each of her findings of misconduct was based on disputed facts. For example, the failure, so-called failure, Wilfred failure to produce the 11 cars at the Northtown Yard. In the sanction hearing, after the order to compel was granted, BNSF showed that it made considerable efforts to get those cars. It made good faith efforts. It was unable to. It supplied letters from the three owners of the different cars that they would not consent. These are cars they own, they use. They're in Canada and around the country.
Counsel, I understand what you're going to tell us here because we did read that, but let's back up for a minute to the incident itself. Whatever the cause, the man is in very bad shape. You'd agree to that. He had neurological
problems. At the time
problems.
Of the incident?
Yes.
That is a disputed fact. He had some effect.
Okay.
He had headaches and nausea, and that's confirmed at the HCMC emergency room. The doctor said he had a mild exposure, and his symptoms were resolving by the time he was released that day.
All right, but they were misled by what they were told he was exposed to, too. I mean, there's a number of things.
That's a highly disputed fact. Okay. The medical testimony, those doctors would say that they would have treated him exactly the same if they had been told that he was exposed to hydrocarbons. It would not have been any different. Symptoms were resolving.
We can argue about, as you say, a disputed fact regarding the seriousness of the... health consequence for this gentleman, but now we're talking about an injury of some sort. Why isn't the scene frozen? Why isn't the audio kept? Why aren't those cars in the immediate vicinity kept until more investigation can be conducted?
The scene was frozen. They evacuated the bowl. There are 66 tracks. There are 600 cars. Everybody was ordered out. And then the hazmat and the three Fridley Fire Department people went in first. They went exactly to the track 14 cars because it was upwind of where the crew reported this incident occurred on track 17. They didn't want to go directly to track 17 because they feared being exposed. So they went to the hydrocarbon cars. They stood right next to them. One of them actually got on top of one. They inspected it visually to see if there are any signs of any release there. They did air monitoring five tracks over from 17, five tracks on the other side of 17, including 14. The fire department, three personnel, stayed at track 14 where the hydrocarbon cars were, and they were waiting for Wenk Engineering to come in and do the more thorough inspection with protective gear on. Wenk came and they did the more thorough inspection, but there was an inspection of the entire yard, and particularly those that were close to track 17.
What happened to the audio?
The audio, standard practice is to preserve 1 hour before and after. They preserved 2 hours before and after.
On the railroad production, the district court made a specific finding that the railroad, your client, had the ability to comply and determine that there was record evidence to support that. We would review, and this court has reviewed, under a clearly erroneous standard. What can you present to us that shows that this was clearly erroneous when we have fact record evidence that supports it?
Well, you don't have any record evidence because there never was an evidentiary hearing. You have paper evidence and you have allegations. There is no record evidence in this case. If you're referring to the failure to produce the 11 cars, the evidence before the court by affidavit was that an effort was made to get them. But perhaps more importantly, BNF said, we will pay, because they won't let us move them to the Northtown Yard, we will pay your expert to go to where they are. We'll pay for it. Now, did did the plaintiff really want to inspect those cars 3 years after the incident, or did they want to set up a claim for sanctions? And I think it's the latter. Well, they were not interested in going to where the cars were.
The point of argument, let's talk about the nature of the sanctions, because that's part of your argument. You're saying that the sanctions were extreme and to the point of contempt of court finding.
Well, that has to do with the financial sanctions. On the sanctions on liability and causation, our argument is that there was no factual basis because all of the misconduct claims, and you indicated earlier in a question, Your Honor, that BNSF had thwarted discovery. They had engaged in discovery. They objected to some discovery requests, of which there were hundreds. They produced thousands of documents, and never did they fail to produce when ordered, except for the 11 rail cars, which they could not produce because it was impossible for them to do so. But they offered this alternative, which was substantial compliance with the order to produce. They said, we'll pay you to go to where they are. And that was compliance. So every one of the alleged items of misconduct that is used as the basis for sanction is disputed. They're all disputed. Now, can a trial judge decide all of those disputed issues summarily without an evidentiary hearing? All of the cases in Minnesota, these issues have been raised after a full trial. They're submitted to a jury. If you believe that the other party has not been forthright in discovery, you ask for an adverse instruction, but you do it having proven the basis for it in a jury trial. You don't do it by competing affidavits where one side says there's a misconduct and the other side said not. Do we want to license district judges to say, well, I'm going to exercise my inherent authority, I'm going to ignore summary judgment rules, and I'm going to summarily decide fact disputes and resolve them in favor of one party based on the paper? No right to confront, no right to cross-examine, no right to refute and rebut, no right to have a jury trial. This is an FELA case where the Supreme Court of the United States has said, and the Eighth Circuit Court has said, and I think this court has recognized, these cases are to go to the jury, FELA cases. Even if you claim that there was a settlement release that you're challenging, typically an equitable claim that would not be a jury, in an FELA case, it's a jury case. Everything is drawn toward the jury.
Mr. Hansen, the crux of your argument indeed was the lack of an evidentiary hearing. And I assume, number one, that the evidentiary hearing would have been limited to the discovery issue or the discovery motion to compel before a sanction is imposed. But have you cited any law in which a reviewing there was error of law in a court who then issued sanctions failed to hold an evidentiary hearing related to those sanctions?
It's never come up in a Minnesota case because there's never been sanctions that have granted without an evidentiary hearing, except where the misconduct was within the knowledge of the court or was admitted by the party being sanctioned. So it's never come up in Minnesota. In the Eighth Circuit, the Flax case, which we discussed.
This isn't a contempt finding.
I'm sorry?
This isn't a contempt finding.
I'm talking about the sanction. I'm not talking about the contempt finding.
A trial court judge is within its discretion to fashion a sanction for discovery violations.
Certainly, if the discovery violations are admitted or within the knowledge of the judge, not requiring external evidence, but where they're contested, such as the production of the 11 cars, where there's an issue on whether good faith was used to produce the cars, whether there's an issue on whether the BNSF offered this practical alternative. You go to the cars. Did that satisfy the obligation to comply with the order? Was that willful disregard or failure, refusal to follow the order? It seems not. Certainly not on the basis of those competing pieces of paper. And the Flax case, the Goldberg case out of the United States Supreme Court, I think the Puller case, all say where you've got these hotly contested issues, the court isn't, even in inherent authority, isn't empowered to decide them summarily on preferring one piece of paper over another. You have to make credibility determinations. You have to have live witnesses. You have to allow due process.
You don't have much time. The audio, you mentioned the audio, the 2 hours each way. Court found that the video was not produced. It found that the shipping papers weren't produced and, in fact, were reconstituted.
The only video not produced, I think, was the video of the parking lot. The video of the scene where the incident occurred was produced. Should they have thought to video the parking lot to capture the plaintiff walking out to the car, to the ambulance? Hardly something you would normally expect.
What about the paperwork that was apparently not produced and then later was reconstituted, as she calls it?
Right. It was gathered from the archives. The requirement is that you maintain that paperwork for 1 year, and BNSF did that. These are the way bills for the 11 cars that they didn't believe were involved in this exposure. As I say, they did inspect those 11 cars, a visual inspection of them, but everything at the time of the incident pointed to the third car on track 17. The plaintiff said that's where the exposure occurred. His co-worker, Mr. Gertz, said that's where the exposure occurred. When they went back to the engine, they told Mr. Schumacher in the engine, it all happened at the third car on track 17.
Your time has run. You'll need to sum up.
I'm sorry?
Your time has run. You'll need to sum up.
If I could add one more thing to that. Not knowing what was in that car, they all explained the odor as the odor of sulfur, and it turns out that was a sulfur car. So BNSF focused on that car because they did, and they would conclude even today that the 11 hydrocarbon cars were not involved, and we think we can prove in a jury trial that they did not release from those cars.
You'll have your rebuttal time, Mr. Hansen.
Good morning. May it please the court, for the record, Eric Magnuson on behalf of Scott Kovalevsky. Paula Josert, his trial counsel, is here with me. A lot of things to cover. I just want to get back to the sulfur dioxide car. Here's what the undisputed facts in the record show. Mr. Kovalevsky and his co-worker were near there when they were overcome by a terrible noxious fume. They didn't know where it came from. The BN has specific protocols in place on how you investigate these things. They went out and looked at the sulfur dioxide cars. They got on top, they pulled the dome, they checked the gauges, they looked for condensate. That's how you inspect a car. They found none. They said, couldn't be the sulfur dioxide car. So two things then happened. They told Mr. Kovalevsky's doctor he was exposed to sulfur dioxide, even though they didn't tell him, we've ruled out the car. They said to the Federal Railroad Administration, this was a false alarm, to which they respond. The Federal Railroad Administration says, all caps, false alarm, question mark? You've got two guys in the hospital. Did you look at other cars? What are you doing?
Well, here's my problem. I was going to say we're off the track. No pun. You know, you're both coming to this court. We're an error-correcting court. You're coming to this court and in relitigating what did or didn't happen, your points of view. And the way I'm interpreting what Mr. Hansen is presenting is he's saying, well, it was summarily decided. It shouldn't be a summary judgment determination. The judge jumped the gun in terms of going ahead. So why respond to that, if you will.
Sure. If I could just finish the thought I was making. Those are undisputed facts that I just related to you. And the undisputed
facts, according to Mr. Hansen, they're disputed.
Well, no. The fact that they ruled out the sulfur dioxide car, that the FRA told them to look around, that their protocols required them to look around, those are undisputed. But let me get to this. What the BN has consistently done here is they conflated merits arguments with sanctions arguments. And there's a big difference. Now, there is no case law that says you have to have an evidentiary hearing when you're considering sanctions. In fact, if you look at the cases that we cited, and I think Domanis from the Seventh Circuit, it's an en banc decision, they look at the whole panoply of possible actions by the court. And they say the policy behind sanctions is to ensure the efficacy and speed of resolution of civil litigation. If you engage in a series of mini trials anytime somebody says there's a problem, you defeat that purpose. There is no requirement in civil sanctions, and Mr. Hansen admitted this, there's no Minnesota case that says you have to have an evidentiary hearing. What you have to have is notice and an opportunity to be heard. And you also have to bear in mind this judge presided over the case throughout its existence. And so there's no support for the proposition she had to have an evidentiary hearing. She could decide this based on the written submissions. She gave them ample notice. They could put in anything they wanted in the form of documents, in the form of affidavits, and they did. What an evidentiary hearing would have done is give Ms. Josert the chance to cross-examine vigorously the statements by the BN. Now, the judge didn't believe their story. She didn't believe it for a number of reasons. She saw in front of her what she considered to be misleading representations by BN's counsel. I think the producing the hydrocarbon cars is a good example. Again, you can't take one piece of this case and say, well, you know, I would have done it differently, let's reverse. Keep in mind, the hydrocarbon failure to produce the cars was but a small part of the overall misconduct. But here's what happened. In May, Ms. Josert asked for the right to inspect the cars. The BN didn't say, well, we can't get them for you. They said, well, the time you've asked us to produce them doesn't work. We're going to have a different time. Then they went in front of the judge, and he didn't say we can't get them. He said there are procedures in place. We've asked for them. We just need a different time. Then later it became, well, we're having trouble arranging them. We may not be able to get them. That lawyer is now replaced, and the new lawyer comes in and says, we just can't do it. It's impossible. And they get a letter from the owner of the car that says, basically, since Mr. Kovalevsky wasn't exposed to the stuff in the cars, we're not going to produce them. Well, where did they get that information? They got it from the BN. The offer to fly us there, this came in September after the original May request. Discovery is now over, but they said, well, we'll fly you and your expert out there. Of course, they give us 2 to 3, 4 days notice. They say, this one's in Spotted Horse, Alberta. This one is in two spots in Michigan. At the final hearing, they made an offer of where the cars were. 2 in Michigan, 2 in Montana, I think, several of them in the northwest part of Canada, and 1 in Alaska. This is when trial is coming up. This is when discovery is all over. So the notion that they fully complied with their obligation to produce those cars, the judge had ample reason to reject that.
Address then, if you will, the type of sanction that was imposed, both the monetary sanction as well as striking the defense. Appellant counsel in its brief is certainly arguing that these were
punitive, criminal.
Punitive.
Right. They're not. There are well-recognized sanctions. A party who obstructs the litigation process is at risk of having its answer stricken or its complaint dismissed. Minnesota courts have recognized that repeatedly.
Did the court need to somehow forewarn appellant counsel that should this happen again, that you
I don't
risk
think
striking?
The court. I think the fact that Ms. Josert repeatedly asked for that as a sanction and the judge didn't do it, and then finally did it is enough warning. But BN is not your normal litigant. BN has been down this road before. And the judge knew that, not because she says, I'm going to punish you because I find that you're habitually a bad actor. What she said was, I have looked at these other cases where the BN has engaged in exactly this kind of conduct. And it is instructive to me, first of all, what the courts did when they saw that, and the sanctions, some of which are the same as here, and the fact that it put BN on notice that if it does these things, there's going to be a consequence. There is a difference between a penalty and a consequence. The consequence is well recognized. You know, in the Seagate case, now I know that it's slightly different because it was an arbitration decision, but to get to where it got, the Supreme Court had to look at the authority of courts to issue sanctions. There's a $600 million default judgment because of one fabricated document. You know, for my colleague to say there are no cases in Minnesota that have ever gone this far is just wrong. There are plenty of cases, and we've cited them to you. We've also cited dozens of cases where the court has said there's no need for an evidentiary hearing when you're talking about the inherent authority of the court. The judge runs her courtroom, and the judge gets to decide whether an evidentiary hearing would be helpful or not. Now, it is different if there are criminal sanctions, like criminal contempt. No contempt here at all. These are compensatory awards. These are remedial awards. They said, look, you know, your defense on the medical part of it is this couldn't possibly have caused his injuries. Well, the experts base that on saying, you don't know what was in the cars. You don't know exactly what it was exposed to, and you don't know the dose. And so while their own experts give lectures around the country about the neurological injuries that can happen from sniffing this stuff, this is dirty oil. This is highly toxic stuff. You know, it's really dangerous. And they said, but you don't have information about the exact composition of what he might have been exposed to and the dosage, and therefore your experts are speculating. Our experts had published studies to support their opinions, and they worked backwards. They said, he has these symptoms, we know he was exposed to something, and we don't know exactly what it was because they didn't preserve the shipping records. They didn't preserve the cars.
Mr. Magnuson, getting to that issue, even assuming then, which I understand Mr. Hansen was perhaps leading up to, all the liability, the sanction of liability, what would be the connection from the discovery issues to the causation, where presume everything, they're liable and the experts can argue before the jury as to whether indeed all that bad actually caused the injury that occurred?
Because
why would that be related?
The crux of the causation defense was you don't know exactly what he was exposed to. So even if something came out of the cars, you can't prove it caused his current condition because you can't prove exactly what it was. The answer is, well, we can't prove exactly what it was because you let the cars out of the yard, you didn't retain the shipping documents. But, you know, this is an example of what BN did in this case. They reconstituted waybills. Now, remember, the FRA told them to look at the other cars, and they didn't. They knew there'd been an exposure. They knew they'd ruled out the one possible source in the sulfur dioxide cars. They didn't do anything to preserve the other stuff. Well, what's the result of that? The result is, in their normal document retention policies, they lost the shipping documents. So they went back and they reconstituted them. I admit, there's a lot of detail here, but if you look at the reconstituted waybills in the record, you'll see they have something called STCC codes. It's government regulation codes that explain what's in them. The three sets of waybills have different STCC codes for the three different versions of the waybills they reconstituted. So then they go to the guy who's in charge of the producer of this stuff who shipped them, and they put those waybills in front of him and say, this wasn't the really bad stuff, was it? And he says, nope, doesn't look like it is to me. Well, Ms. Josert, through her tenacity, got finally, in the thousands of documents that were dumped on her at the last minute, a BNSF document, a bill of lading. A waybill is simply a description of contents. A bill of lading is a receipt that the customer gets, and it says casing head well oil. It says exactly what we've been claiming all along. And she shows it to the producer, who's now said, based on these waybills that, you know, change, he says, well, they really shouldn't change. And he had no explanation why it was different from the BNSF own document. Here's the point. 3.5 years into this case, she has to reconstruct what happened because BN didn't follow its own procedures. If there is ever a case where there is notice and reason to know that they should be preserving this stuff, this is it. Their own claims manual, the Federal Railroad Administration, and their experience in other cases told them, you can't just ignore this stuff, and they did. Now, Your Honor,
your time is ticking off
it
really
is.
Quickly. I would really like to hear your position on the federal post-judgment interest rate in light of the fact that Judge Shalhous was the opinion author
yep.
on Albee, and it's been taken to the Supreme Court. What is your opinion or suggestion as to what we do with that issue?
I think you wait for Albee to be decided. But I think, let me put it this way. Even if you were to conclude that it's not controlled by state law, it's controlled by federal law, the remedy for you is to remand it to Judge Dawson to see if there's an alternative basis. You have the Frazier case from this court, and in Frazier you affirmed a 10.3% annual return. It was what BNSF earned on its money during the period of time it delayed Mr. Frazier's case. And so if Albee comes down and he says you can't do the 10% because it's state law and it needs to be federal law, there's an alternative basis, and you ask Judge Dawson in your judgment, what would you do? And that would give us an opportunity to look into how much money did the BNSF earn during the 3 years it delayed the litigation. Remember, Kovalevsky is exposed to this stuff. His doctors are told, sulfur dioxide, you'll get over it. It's not the kind of thing that causes neurological problems. And what does he do? He tries to get over it. He spends the next 3 years before he hires a lawyer who starts the lawsuit thinking he's got something else. That's the delay. That's the damage for delay. When they finally gets a lawyer who digs deep enough to find the facts, the lawsuit started and it's over in a year, but it is 4 years instead of 1 year. It's delayed. That's the damage that he suffered. I'm almost out of time. Let me just conclude this. In Patton versus Newmar, the court said the party seeking to overturn sanctions has a heavy burden. They have to convince the appellate court that no reasonable person would do what the district court did. This is a thick record. It's just thousands of pages long. There was a trial judge who sat through the whole thing. And if you accept the BN's argument that there has to be an evidentiary hearing when sanctions like this are posed, you are going to upset the balance of between efficient adjudication, and you're going to embrace what the Manus court said is a series of mini trials. That's specifically rejected by the federal authorities. You should reject it as well. You should affirm. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Magnuson. Mr. Hansen, you have the last word.
Thank you, Your Honor. The Seagate case that he mentioned, the Frazier case involving BNSF, all of these cases where sanctions were ordered was done after trial. Seagate had, 12 weeks of arbitration hearings. The facts regarding the sanction came out during the trial. We're not saying you have to have mini trials every time there's a sanction request. If the judge has personal knowledge of the grounds for sanctions, if the party doesn't dispute, as in patent, they destroyed the product that was the claim beforehand, no, there's no hearing required. A judge can decide on undisputed facts. But where the facts underlying the misconduct are disputed, then they have to be submitted to trial. They should be submitted to the jury in a case like this. Now, causation, I have to correct a statement by counsel. He said the experts of BNSF wavered on what was contained in the hydrocarbon cars. They did not. They are the only people who testified, because there was a FRIMAC hearing where BNSF took the position that the plaintiff's experts were using a novel scientific theory. They were asked in that hearing, assume all of the worst contained in that car that the plaintiff claims, wellhead casing oil and all of the components that it might have. Assume that was in those cars. Assume that they were coupled over speed, and we can prove they were not. Mr. Rader, the witness, calculated the speed of those cars, and it was under 4 miles an hour, and all the evidence is you have to be going 8 miles an hour to cause any kind of compression release. But assume that to be true. Assume that somehow a release came from those cars and got over to Mr. Kowalewski. Could he possibly have, from that incident, had the cause of his current condition, and they said no. That kind of an open-air, transient release of gases, even the worst of those gases, is incapable of causing, and all the medical literature supports it, and any opinion to the contrary would be novel scientific theory not supported by generally accepted medical science. So the causation issue, just looking at that alone, there was no basis to sanction by dismissing the causation defense because it assumed all of the worst things that the plaintiff claimed BNSF had done. Counsel said that BNSF cleared the sulfur car. They did not. They knew that at 1 o'clock in the afternoon, 3 hours after the incident, it wasn't leaking. They couldn't detect any leaks at that time. They concluded that there had been apparently a small release from that car back at 10 o'clock when the incident occurs. Coincidentally, right next to that set of cars was an open gondola that had creosote ties that gave off a strong odor similar to the one that was explained by the workers. They didn't clear that sulfur car and therefore threw up their hands and say, we don't know. They thought that a small release had occurred at that car, and they did inspect the other cars. As I said, they stood right next to the 11 hydrocarbon cars for about an hour before somebody actually went into the sulfur dioxide car. So there was no basis for the court to determine, as a central finding, I think, for her sanctions, that somehow BNSF had a sham investigation here, tried to mislead people to the sulfur dioxide car. It wasn't their idea, it was the crew's idea. Mr. Gertz, who was on that crew, had no lasting effects from this exposure. He went to work when he was next scheduled to be to work, and he said in his statement, I had no effects from the exposure. 2 days later, he was right there with the plaintiff. Now the question of, is BNSF a habitual sanctionable party simply because they're a defendant? BNSF has thousands of employees. They do not, corporate BNSF was not running this investigation. Barb Schutte, the person in the hump tower, to whom the crew reported that it was the third car on track 17, is the one who directed Mr. Doremus, the hazmat inspector, to go to that car. Did she concoct a conspiracy to separate people and have them look at the wrong car? If I could add one more thing, the judge even found, and five times in her order she says, the sulfur dioxide car wasn't even there until 3 o'clock in the afternoon. Look at Exhibit J, the Wenk report. It has a photo of the sulfur dioxide car. The three Fridley fired people who went out saw the sulfur dioxide car. The video shows the sulfur dioxide car. Mr. Kowalewski said he walked to the sulfur dioxide car. Five times she relies on that as a fact, and it simply is not a fact. It's contradicted by all of the evidence. Thank you.
Thank you to both counsel. The matters were well briefed as well as well argued. A decision will be issued in the statutory time frame. That does conclude our oral argument calendar. We are in adjournment.